This podcast is sponsored by Runway, air traffic control for your mobile releases. Put your releases on autopilot. Runway will shepherd your release from kickoff to submission to release with no manual intervention. A single source of truth for your releases. Runway integrates with your favorite tools for a bird's eye view over release progress and blockers. Make your releases collaborative. Get a rich, contextualized release runbook that makes capturing responsibilities and tracking tasks crystal clear. Get more control on your releases on App Store and Play Store. Point your browser to runway.team. Thank you for sponsoring my podcast. I'm also revamping my newsletter. Check it out, appforce1.net to sign up. You can also find a sign-up link on my Twitter profile. Welcome to another special episode of my podcast. I'm sitting here with Chris Vaselli. He is the creator of the Nihongo app. And it's an interesting story he likes to share with us because he's an indie developer, but in his own words, he took a while to get there. And we're probably going to dig into this a lot more. And by the sound of it, he's someone that is further along the same path that that I'm on currently, because I have my day job and I do some stuff on the side. So, Chris, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, how are you doing today?
I'm pretty good. It's cold here in Vermont. Got snow on the ground, so that's nice.
So, and it's now, at your place, it's afternoon, right?
Yeah, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Okay. Just to get things started, most people, if they know you, they probably know you from your product, Nihongo. Can you tell a little bit about that product?
Yeah, sure. Nihongo is, you know, I talk about it as a Japanese dictionary and study tool. Basically, it's got, you know, a full Japanese dictionary in it, and then flashcards and some tools so you can, like, paste, copy and paste text into it and look up words from the pasted text really easily. As of about 6 months ago, you can now take pictures of you know, Japanese text that you see out in the world, or if you're reading manga or something, you can take pictures to look up words. But the sort of unique thing that I was trying to do with building Nihongo was to make it easy to have more context for the words that you're studying. So instead of just going and getting a list of vocabulary off the internet, the 1,000 most common words in Japanese or something like that, it's all about finding ways to study words that you're actually encountering in your real life, or in, you know, if you're into video games, playing Japanese video games, or if you're living in Japan, things you're encountering in real life. So every word that you look up in the dictionary automatically gets turned into a flashcard. And when you, like, copy and paste text into the app, it automatically finds all the words in it and turns those into flashcards. So, and then it sort of links back to those. So if you're looking at a word later, you can see, oh, I saw this, you know, this word showed up from this chapter of an ebook I was reading, or this manga I was reading, or something like that. So that's kind of the basic premise of the app, is really trying to add more context to the words and vocabulary that you're studying in Japanese.
Why a Japanese dictionary app?
Yeah, I mean, it all started, I was living in Japan. I lived in Japan for 2 years. And when I was there, I was studying Japanese full-time at a Japanese language school. And it was kind of just the, you know, the app that I wish existed. So, you know, I can actually tell this story where when I was starting off in Japan, I was studying in Japan. You know, I had apps that I was using. I had a flashcard app. I used one called Flashcards Deluxe. I had a Japanese dictionary app that I was using. You know, I would try to look up words in my Japanese dictionary and then make the flashcards in Flashcards Deluxe to, like, be to study those words that I'm actually encountering. It got so tedious, just this act of constantly trying to write out all of the definitions of the word, looking them up, copying the definitions over, and making flashcards. I ended up finding myself spending way more time just making the flashcards than I was actually studying and learning. So I ended up, my first sort of attempt at solving this problem was I figured out that the Japanese dictionary app I used had an export option where you could export to, like, a CSV file, and you could export that to Dropbox. And the flashcard app I used had an import that you could import, you know, obviously completely different format. But so I had this whole thing set up where when I was living in Japan, I'd leave my laptop sitting out on my little desk in my tiny Japanese apartment connected to the internet. I had a folder action so that it would detect when a new file got added to a certain folder in Dropbox. It would detect when I, like, uploaded one of these exported word lists from the dictionary app, run a script that would convert the file from the format that they export to the format expected by my flashcard app, and then I could go on my phone and go and then down, you know, wait 30 seconds and then go and download it into my flashcard app from Dropbox. So I kind of got to this point where I was like, wait, there's got to be, you know, a better way to do this. and that's kind of where Nihongo, that was like the first thing I did with Nihongo, was basically build out a dictionary that would automatically create flashcards from the words I looked up. That was like feature number one. And that's just something that I wanted for myself. And then it's all sort of like, that was the core sort of flow I wanted. And then I've sort of added onto that and added on and added on for a while now.
I'm hearing a lot of interesting stuff, because I know the Nihongo app is an iOS application. You're an iOS developer. Do you study Japanese in Japan? How the heck did all that happen?
Well, where do I start, I guess?
Let's start at the beginning. Okay. Sure. When did you grow an interest into computers, computer science, maybe programming?
Sure. It all kind of grew out of video games for me. I was really into video games as a kid. I still am very into video games. So in my freshman year of high school, I took my first programming class, and I took a Visual Basic class. So, this is all, Visual Basic is very focused on forms and buttons and fields and sort of just the basic sort of stuff like that.
Was that visualbasic.net or Visual Basic 5 or 6?
Oh man, I don't remember. So this was 2001. So whatever it would have been then.
Yeah, I think that was like before the Common Language Runtime. So that would be like the true original Visual Basic.
Yeah. So I was learning this stuff, and but there was some point where we learned how to make like a shape, and then I learned how to do keyboard input, and then there was like, then one day they introduced the timer.
Uh-oh.
And it was just this moment where, like, wait, I have a shape, I have keyboard input, and I have a timer. I could make a game with this. And it was like this light bulb moment. And I went home that night and I made Pong, you know, just like a basic two-player Pong that, like, okay, if I detect if the keyboard is, you know, I have a timer that runs, and then every whatever number of, you know, seconds or frames or whatever, it detects if the key is down, and then it moves this shape around. And, yeah, I mean, in retrospect, that was a pretty pivotal moment for me that I kind of figured out how to do that. And then I went on and took Java classes in high school and switched over mostly to doing Java stuff. But in high school, I just did a lot of making games. Like, I made a lot of 2D stuff. I liked to just play around with seeing how to build games in different genres. So I made, you know, a platformer game. I made a sort of shmup, shoot 'em up game. I made like an Advance Wars style strategy game, and just played around with it a lot and loved doing that. So that's kind of how I got into the coding side. And then I went to college and got a degree in computer science. I ended up just really sticking with that and really enjoying doing that. And I went to work at my first job out of college. Actually, I had an internship in college, and then that went to my full-time job, was at a company called Big Fix. And they're like enterprise security management stuff. So very sort of the kind of software that you'd have installed on, like, say you're a company with like hundreds of thousands of computers all over the world, and you need to be able to have visibility into what software is installed on them, and you know, what if they have the latest patches, what their energy, you know, power saving settings are, like all this sort of stuff. So we wrote like a little client that would run on all the machines, and then, you know, a server component that could and control and you know, deploy patches and things like that. So very different from what I'm doing now.
So just to recap a little bit, you did Visual Basic in your freshman year in, was it high school?
High school, yeah.
Yeah. And then you took Java classes, you graduated, and yet then you started working at this company that did remote management of machines.
Yeah.
So, and then what happened? Because we're not like in any way, shape or form close to an indie developer lifestyle by the sounds of it.
No. I mean, that was around the time I started doing some side projects. Again, I did a game So my first iOS project was a game called Pipe Drop, which is still out there on the App Store. And that was like iOS maybe, I think I started in iOS 2, I think it was iOS 4 by the time I actually released it, but very early going of iOS, and did that on the side. The company I worked for got bought by IBM. I stayed there for a little bit, but then was kind of just not really wanting to work for IBM and wanted to do something different. So my husband got a job teaching English in Japan through the JET program. And so I went with him to Japan. I basically left my job and did the full-time Japanese language classes for 2 years while I was there. And during that time was when, you know, actually my original plan when I went to Japan was I wanted to just make games. Like, I went there with the idea, okay, I'm leaving my job. This is my chance to just do my own thing. I'm going to be an indie game developer. You know, that was my plan.
And how young were you then?
Oh yeah, 21, something like that. I don't know. Yeah.
Okay. Still full of ideas and hope and dreams.
Yeah. Exactly.
Which is good, because that's what you need to be at that age.
Gosh, I
sound old now.
No, I know. Yeah. Dreams, what are those?
So yeah, you were in Japan, focusing your attention to the Japanese language and the indie game developer lifestyle.
Yep.
So you mentioned your husband. So were you already married at that point, or was it still something that was ahead in the future?
We were married by then.
Okay.
Yeah. So got married maybe a year before we left for Japan.
So how did the two of you meet?
We met in high school, actually.
Ah, cool.
We met my freshman year of high school.
High school sweethearts.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we met in high school and then got married, actually, exactly 10 years after we met.
So yeah, then you were in Japan.
Yep.
Studying, trying to become an indie app developer. Then what happened?
Yeah. So, you know, what I found was, as much as I liked making games, these like little projects that were just kind of fun, trying to build a game engine for, you know, a platformer, or game engine for this or that. When I decided I wanted to get serious about it, I decided, you know, it doesn't really make sense for me to making these game engines. Game engines have been kind of commoditized. I'm not sure if that's the right word, but there's Unity. There's all these things that the engineer in me said, it makes no sense for me to be spending my time rebuilding this from scratch. I should be using the tools that are out there, and then I can just focus on the actual game-making part. The problem with that was, once I started to do that, I find I didn't like that nearly as much. I just found that, like, without the technical challenges of trying to actually build, you know, the internals of the game, and more focused on just, like, game design and the game scripting sort of stuff, I like it, but not something I could do, you know, 40 hours a week and be satisfied with that. So
you pivoted from game development to other areas of software development.
Yeah, exactly. So it was really then that I sort of had, around that time when I was kind of realizing that, and honestly, that was a tough realization. That was hard, because this was something I had been thinking about since I was a kid, you know, wanting to be a game developer, and then realizing, you know, all this sort of goal I had been striving for so long, and then feeling like I wasn't living up to that, you know, that was really, really hard. And one of the things that really helped pull me out of that was just finding something to dive into and really get passionate about, which I was like, okay, this thing that I really want to exist, and just really focusing on that. And, you know, so that's when I kind of started working on Nihongo, and yeah, it was really, sort of a tool for me to really pull out of kind of what could have been a really bad depression, I think, was just having this thing to focus on. And you know, I'm really glad I did now. It's, the story that goes from there then is, we come back from Japan. I basically launched Nihongo about a month before we came back from Japan. And for the next, like, 2 years, it basically didn't make any money. And I was fine with that. I basically had built it for myself, and I wanted to launch it on the App Store as, you know, an accomplishment, but wasn't really focused on it making money. I went back and joined a new company with some of my colleagues from my Big Fix days. We formed a startup. I worked on that. That startup got acquired by Box, And so I went and worked at Box for 4 years, I think it was, or maybe three.
And in the meantime, you kept adding and improving Nihongo?
Yeah, so I kept on it on the side when I could and kept building it and got to a point where, you know, it was making enough. My initial goal was definitely to stick it out until, you know, I could have that be, you know, a full-time income. And I didn't quite get there before I left to go on it full-time, but I got to the point where I felt like, okay, I have a path here. We have enough savings to sort of...
Yeah, you could decide upon, I give myself an X amount of time, and if it succeeds, it succeeds. If it fails, then we'll just consider other options.
Exactly, that's right. So that's the point that I got to after, I guess 4 years at Box, and that was 2 years ago now, so... and it's continued to grow, and now I'm doing it, I wouldn't say I'm a full-time indie developer, because I really split my time with being just a stay-at-home dad. I have a four-year-old kid now, and so it's, you know, a pretty great lifestyle that I get to, you know, keep on working on this while he's at school, and then spend a lot of time, you know, in the afternoons, and get to sort of have that half of my life, that sort of half-fulfilling half of my life as well.
Okay, so just to grab back a bit on Box, you were what was your role there? As iOS software developer or?
So I came in. I did a bunch of different things at Box, actually. I came in as part of this group that was doing this security related work, and I actually went on the iOS app team, sort of as almost like a guest developer on their team for a while. I wasn't really part of their team, but I came on to do some security work. So I developed this extra level of encryption, an extra layer of encryption in their iOS app on top of what Apple provides. So that was basically based on your like Box credentials and your Box, like a Box specific credentials. And then I went and we were building out our Box for desktop, which is, it got released as Box Drive is the name, the public name for it. And so I was the Mac developer for that. So I basically built from scratch their Mac UI for their desktop client. And then my like last year there, I just decided to try something totally different that I've never done before, and I went and worked on their web app team for a year. So
it gives you a valuable experience and techniques that you can now use for Nihongo, I guess. But Nihongo, you did it as a passion project for quite some time. And at some point, you started gaining income from it. But could you look back and say what were key moments in the business model of Nihongo that actually allowed you to start creating an income out of it and actually growing that out to like a sustainable income for you and your family?
Yeah, sure. The first key moment, I mean, the first things are just around pricing. I started as a single $4 in-app purchase to unlock clippings and flashcards, so basically extra functionality.
So that was like a pay-once model.
Yep, pay-once model. At some point, I decided to up that to $8 and like basically got the same number of sales at $8 as $4, maybe a little bit less, but like there was just no reason to do it at $4 instead of $8. Then the next big moment that I had was when I had a big surge in downloads from China. And this was kind of surprising to me as it was an English-Japanese dictionary. Why am I getting all these downloads from China? And I eventually found that there was a someone on like a Japanese, or not, I'm sorry, a Chinese sort of Q&A website, almost like Quora, but in Chinese, had written up almost like a guide to how to use my app to look up Japanese words, then get and use all the features of the app to get to Japanese words. And then when you have the English definition to run it through at the time it was a workflow, now shortcuts, iOS shortcuts, to automatically then translate that to Chinese. And so there was this whole contingent of people that were using it. And it was like a highly upvoted post that drove all this traffic to my app. So I took that as a sign that I needed to take this Chinese users more seriously, and went ahead and spent a bunch of time working on localization into Chinese. And I couldn't get access to a data source for definitions of Japanese words in Chinese, but I just did what they were doing and tried to make it a better experience. So I machine translated all of the English definitions up front and added them in basically next to the English. You can have it so that it'll show the Chinese machine translation, and all of the like searching within the app will search against the Chinese machine translations and things like that. So it just kind of gives it a little more first class support to this flow of having the Chinese translations. So that has been really popular in China for a long time, was my largest market, up until maybe 6 months to a year ago. Which was kind of mind-boggling to me, and I never would have thought of that Chinese machine translations of the English definitions of Japanese words would be useful to anyone. But it was. So that was a big one.
Okay. And you mentioned that source of downloads sort of dried up like a year ago, you mentioned?
It leveled off.
Leveled off. Okay.
Whereas I'm getting growth elsewhere. The Chinese stuff has kind of leveled off, or maybe gone down a little bit in the last mm-hmm. year. Whereas I'm finally kind of getting traction in Europe and in the United States now that I didn't have before. So I've continued to go on and do localizations into more languages. A lot of all the other languages, I actually have native written definitions for the Japanese words.
Mm-hmm. So how big is the word list for Japanese terms in your dictionary app?
It's about, right now it's at about 190,000 mm-hmm. Japanese words. So it uses a project called JMDict, which a lot of the Japanese dictionaries and apps you'll find out there use. So that's, up to about 190,000 with English translations. And then I think the second highest is Russian or German, I think at like 60 or 80,000 or something like that.
So, and with each localization you do, you have to do a translation, or that's already available in this JMDict data source?
So I do the translations for the UI of the app, but I the translations for the UI, and then I have a whole system set up that'll automatically, every time I have a Jenkins job that every week it downloads the new JMDict file, finds all of the unmachine translated strings, all of the strings that don't have a translation into, say, German, and it'll run those through a machine translator. So when you're using the app in German, maybe all of the common entries will have native translations. All of the other entries will have machine translated translations. And so every time I add a language, it's sort of adding that, but it's mostly automated at this point.
So how many languages does the app support?
It's English, German, Spanish, French, traditional Chinese, simplified Chinese, and Russian.
Okay. So, and because there's a big difference between language as Westerners know it, compared to, for instance, China or Japan, because they have like these symbols that they use for writing, is mm-hmm. that like challenging to wrap your head around if you're any regular iOS app developer out there, or how is it to like work with these symbolic languages?
Yeah. I mean, there's some quirks to it. Like fonts are kind of a funny thing. I'll give you an example mm-hmm. of a bug that's very specific to that. I was getting these reports that like things were getting cut off, like strings were, elements of the UI were getting cut off and things like that, or looking wrong, or showing the wrong character. And what I finally realized is, because the system font is San Francisco, and San Francisco doesn't exist for Chinese or Japanese. They have their own like fonts that are effectively the system font. The system font for Chinese draws certain characters differently than the system font for Japanese. And if your phone is, say, in English, you have like the preferred language order, if Chinese is above Japanese, it's going to use the Chinese version of the characters when it draws them. So even in my app, when I'm trying to display Japanese characters, it'll display them using the system font in Chinese, which is going to display them differently than the Japanese font. So funny things like that, where I have to, like, I can't rely on the system font displaying things in a consistent way. So I have to be really careful to be like using the correct font in different places, making sure I'm using a Japanese font. Other than that, I mean, Apple is all of the, you know, stuff in Objective-C and Swift all use UTF-8 strings pretty easily and universally. So there's not a lot of challenge there. You kind of get into all the same challenges that you have with localizing in any language. So like Russian has been tricky just because it's a lot of the text in Russian comes out really, really long.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the sort of classic localization problems like that. But
okay. Currently, the app is listed with in-app purchases that are recurring. Is that a change that you made a long time ago? Or when did you switch from the single purchase to like a subscription model?
Yeah, that's kind of the next next step of that story.
I noticed that you have recurring subscriptions in your app. When did you create that change? Because you mentioned the leveling off of the Chinese market like a year ago. But when did you make the change from a single purchase to a subscription-based model?
Yeah, that was about 3 or 4 years ago. And that was another big moment that had a big impact on the income from the app. I did it just about when Apple started allowing apps to switch to subscription models, apps that weren't doing, you know, content updates, but were doing feature updates. So I made that switch, and that definitely had a big impact. I'd guess it maybe doubled my income from the app switching to that. So I switched from a single $8 in-app purchase to a recurring subscription with a lifetime option. The lifetime option was effectively the same in-app purchase. It actually is the exact same in-app purchase as the $8 purchase used to be. But I switched to something where I now have an $8 per 3 month subscription, a $20 per year, or a $50 lifetime.
Yeah.
And so that's helped a lot. That was a big, big help.
So what was the feedback that you were getting when you made this change to your product? Because obviously the people that already had the lifetime subscription option at a low rate, they could continue working with the app the way it already was, I guess. Any feedback, positive or negative, when you made this change?
Very little. I mean, I think most people that owned it already probably were oblivious to the fact that the price changed. I did get like one really nasty app store review of someone saying, "Oh, this person's, you know, price gouging, that, you know, don't pay attention to any of these 5-star reviews. They're all from before he changed the pricing. And now, you know, I don't know." So something like that. So I got a little bit of pushback on that, but, not a significant amount, not enough to worry about it.
But does it change the way that you look or deal with your product and feature development if you have like either initially you had like single purchase events and now you have like pretty much a recurring income stream because people are subscribed to your product? Does that change your way of working or how you deal with feature releases on your product?
It does. And the biggest thing about it that I really love is it sort of aligns what I want to be spending my time on with what's going to make me more money. And what I mean by that is when I had a single in-app purchase, once someone purchased it, that was it. Like, they weren't going to be able to give me any more money. So I ended up feeling compelled to spend a lot more time on marketing and trying to get people to make that one purchase, you know, trying to get people, improve the experience, the like free part of the app, improve the, the marketing and try and do Facebook ads and all this sort of stuff. Once I switched to a subscription model, all of a sudden, actually just making this paid experience of the app better so that people will continue their subscriptions is directly tied to how much money I make from the app. So that really feels great because that's the part that I really enjoy more. Much more than the marketing is actually building out new features. And now that's like, I can feel really good that, well, this is what I need to be doing to keep my subscribers happy.
So, and how sticky are your subscribers, if I might ask?
It's a good question. I'm it's still steadily growing. I think I'm up to maybe a little over 1,000 subscribers now. So, I definitely have significant churn, but it's overall, I'm you know, growing slowly. So I feel pretty good about that. And, you know, some people are going to be taking a Japanese language class for a semester or something, and then they're not going to use Japanese anymore. So I understand that.
And, yeah.
I don't expect people to sort of use it forever.
So let's see. We talked about Nihongo in a sense. Nihongo is currently an iOS app, and I think it also runs on the new M1 Apple Silicon, if people try that. So how's that experience been for you, like supporting somewhat like this new platform, even though it is strictly an iOS app by the looks of it?
It's kind of nice in a way that I can dip my toes into the Mac Catalyst world, and I can get an app out there without needing to deal with all of the, you know, making sure I have x86 versions of all of the libraries that I'm importing and things like that. So I did get the developer transition kit, and I built Nihongo on it, which was kind of a pain, to be honest. Like, these DTKs are definitely rough products, not meant for public consumption. So, but I got it running, and I was able to fix a couple crashes, and I adjusted some of the text, you know, that was very iOS specific, like go to the settings app and do XYZ. I could change to go to system preferences and do this and things like that. So I have, I think, a grand total of maybe 20 users that are on the Mac version right now. And I don't have an M1 Mac yet. So they're kind of, you know, out in the Wild West there right now.
Yeah, they're testing it for you.
Exactly. They're testing it for me. And, you know, I'd be happy to fix anything if it goes wrong. But it's not a focus right now just because the number of people is so small. But like I said, it was a nice way actually to kind of test the waters. And I think if I go and do a Mac Catalyst now, Mac Catalyst version, a lot of the a good chunk of the work has already been done just getting that the M1 Mac version going. So it sort of splits up that work nicely. And I think I'd like to do it. I think it's a natural app to do a Mac Catalyst version because a lot of people want to create their flashcard decks on the Mac or copy and paste text from a website that they're viewing on their Mac or things like that. And then they want to study their flashcards they want to do on their phone, and they want to read their, you know, ebook or manga or something they want to do on their iPad. So it's like there's a really natural way to use Nihongo on all these devices. So it's a pretty natural fit to do Mac Catalyst.
So if you look at the product, is there any backend involved with Nihongo, or is all the data packaged in the app binary?
It's basically all in the app binary. It's actually been really nice as, you know, a developer with experience in apps that have more of a backend component. Just like from a testing perspective, it's so nice to not have to worry about having a backend that you're interacting with and have everything feel a little more self-contained and deterministic is nice. But yeah, I'm working on cloud syncing right now, and that's going to be the biggest sort of, you know, quote unquote backend feature I have. But even that is, I'm not running my own servers. I'm just using CloudKit and letting, you know, Apple do that part.
So yeah, you're using the CloudKit key value data store most likely, I guess, to sync the data between the devices.
I'm using that for this, like preferences and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I'm using a library called Ensembles for the syncing because that's mostly a core data-based app. And I tried out the core data over CloudKit stuff that Apple added in iOS 13 and didn't quite fit my needs. Mm-hmm. So I'm using a library called Ensembles, which then basically Ensembles is just a layer that sits atop any cloud file system. So you can choose your backend. It could be CloudKit, it could be Firebase, it could be, you know, Dropbox, any number of things. But I'm choosing to use CloudKit for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it scales nicely with the amount of usage of your product.
Yeah, and I don't have to pay anything.
So basically, nice. the data is serialized into CloudKit records then.
Yeah, so basically, Ensembles does everything in terms of files.
Okay.
And so it treats CloudKit almost as if it were like a virtual, like a file system. So you actually have each record represents a file, and then you have a record that represents like a directory and things like this. So it's sort of this weird abstraction layer where it's turning CloudKit into a file system, mm-hmm. even though that's not how it really normally is. And then Ensemble sort of works with having files that contain lists of changes, basically like these JSON files that are lists of this, you know, this core data object with this identifier made a change to this property. And so it's all sort of there's sort of a bunch of layers of abstraction there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, the cool part is that you don't have to run your own data center now. And
yeah.
And when is this syncing feature, is it already live or are you still working on it?
Still working on it. Hoping maybe by the end of this month mm-hmm. I can get it out. But it was one of these features that I started, back in June or something, and thought this year would go a little differently. So I thought I'd have it out by the end of September, and here we are in January, and it's not done yet.
So, what are your plans for 2021 with Nihongo and your indie dev lifestyle?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a huge backlog. I get feature requests from people all the time, so I want to, you know, tick off some of those common feature requests. Adding example sentences onto a flashcards is a big one. Things like search as you type, you know, the searches right now you have to type something out and hit enter, so I want to make that faster. And then the bit larger scope things is, I think a Mac Catalyst version is something I'd love to tackle this year. I was waiting on the cloud syncing before doing that, because I think, like I said, I think your phone is still going to be kind of your primary tool for Nihongo, mm-hmm. and the Mac is a little bit of a secondary one, and so you really need to be able to sync the data for that to work well. So, but now that I've got the cloud syncing almost done, Mac Catalyst app would be great.
Mm-hmm. One thing that we didn't discuss yet about your product is that you also use the camera to detect Japanese literatures from any source out there. Any challenges there to actually do the machine translation of what you actually capture with the camera to something that is usable within your app?
Yeah, there was a lot that went into that feature. The first thing I did was I spent a lot of time trying to get Tesseract to work well. This is a library that's been around for maybe 20 years. Google sponsors it now. And with Tesseract, I'd be running the machine or the OCR, the optical character recognition on device. Mm-hmm. And that was really appealing to me because, you know, the app is so, there's no backend for the app right now. So that was really appealing to just keep it on device. You don't have to have an internet connection.
Mm-hmm.
So I started by working really hard at trying to get Tesseract to work well and just was not getting good results. I'd have accuracy in the like 60 to 70% range, whereas Google's OCR, cloud OCR, would be like 95%.
Yeah.
So I ended up, you know, building a whole tool set that's agnostic to what backend you're using. You could stick Tesseract in there. You could do a call off to Google's servers or Microsoft's or any other service.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up settling on Google's just because they're, you know, I was getting the best performance from them. So I ended up using Google's cloud backend. But then the other thing that I really wanted to focus on was coming up with a better way to present this to users. So a really common pattern that you'll see in apps for doing OCR is you have a little sort of viewfinder box, mm-hmm. and you drag around this viewfinder box in the corners of this and position it over the text that you want to do the OCR on, and then it'll like show the definition of that word next to it or something like that.
Yeah.
Or in the case of Google Translate, you take a picture and then you like scrub your finger over the text and just sort of draw around the text you want.
Okay.
So I wanted to try something different, and what I came up with was this idea of having the text basically turn blue and make it look like you can just tap on it. And so that's what I did, is I basically made it so every word that it detects, it highlights in blue, and you can tap on them to like get a little popover that shows the definition.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of work that went into that of doing, I actually got to dive into some core image stuff and metal shaders, and to do that, thresholding the where you try to detect the edge of the character, so that I could turn just the pixels within the character blue.
Mm-hmm.
Because what you get back from Google is just a bounding box around the text that it detected. But I wanted to actually highlight very precisely the character and turn it blue in the image. And so that was actually a lot of fun and really interesting new area to get into of trying to do that thresholding and image processing stuff.
Okay. And this is typically because, if I'm correct, you're using the online Google Cloud Vision API for this.
Yep.
But this is typically one of those features that you cannot do without a subscription. This is a feature that you cannot do without a subscription model, right? Because if it's a one-time purchase, then how are you going to offset the costs of interacting with this API, I guess?
It's true. And that's one, you know, good case for doing the subscription model. I was paranoid about that. I was very paranoid. Like, it's really a little scary when you're first going to launch this feature and like, well, what if people are, you know, taking 50 photos a day and I totally miscalculated and I'm going to go broke. But I actually end up spending, I send $20 to Google a month or something.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I probably could not, you know, I'm not worried about my lifetime subscribers, you know, making me go bankrupt or anything.
Okay. Well, really cool, because basically it's a simple app if you look at it, Nihongo. But it packs a lot of features, and you do some interesting things within the app, just to streamline the process for the end user. So people learning Japanese probably will end up with this app quite naturally, I think. So are there any other things that you would like to share with my listeners?
I mean, I think that's been, I guess I would love to just emphasize that my path was not, you know, straight to, you know, high profitability. This was something that I really enjoyed, finding something that I wanted to work on. I was happy to be working on it every day because I was using it every day and it was something that I wanted. And going into that with that mindset, I think made it a lot less stressful. Mm-hmm. I think just to be able to not be so much focused on making a ton of money, but just building something that I loved and I wanted, and then sort of nurturing that on the side.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think from the time that I started it to now, it's been about 8 years, I think. And so it's just been kind of a slow, steady process. And, you know, that's a totally legitimate alternative path towards indie development.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, because it's now, I think, 4 years ago that you really started gaining traction on the product, right?
And yeah, that's about right.
And when did you actually quit your day job and fully focus on Nihongo?
About 2 years ago now.
2 years ago. Okay, cool. So yeah, that's an interesting journey, I think, and it's interesting to hear that you actually took a while to actually develop the product, because you really were scratching your own itch, and in the end you ended up with something that was, well, maybe by chance, I don't know how focused you were on actually marketing it, but that it was really something that was marketable and created a sustainable income for you and your family. Any parting words of wisdom or tips that you'd like to share with people?
I think another thing is just don't tie your own self-worth to your professional goals. I think that was a lesson I learned really hard with that experience of trying to become an indie game developer. I think keeping a fair distance between that and realizing that, you know, there's other paths that your life can take, and that's good too. And to not sort of have your heart set in one direction was something that was important for me to learn. And I would definitely suggest anybody else that's trying to do this to sort of have that flexibility in mind.
So keep your mind open and find what you're passionate about.
Yeah.
Okay, Chris, thank you very much for your time. It was an interesting story you were able to share with people that are listening. And thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Lead Developer, best practices and tips for lead software developers. PDF, MOBI and EPUB format. appforce1.net/lead developer. All one word.